Don't Explain, sung by Sheila Jordan. And Sheila Jordan is my guest in the studio. She's a superb singer with a devoted following amongst jazz listeners, but it's only recently that her name is becoming familiar to more casual listeners. Jordan decided a long time ago that she wanted to sing what she wanted to sing, and that she'd prefer to make her money through a day job than to have to sing material she didn't like, or to have to sing in a style unfaithful to her nature. So, at the age of about 53 now, she's been still relying on her job as a typist at a New York advertising agency for her money, while she plays gigs and records on weekends and vacations. But things seem to be changing, as far as I can tell. There's a feature story recently on her in Downbeat, and a recent story on her in Mother Jones, and there'll be an article about her in the New York Times next week. Her two recent albums on the ECM record label with Steve Coon and Steve Swallow have been well received, and she's been playing in the States and in Europe. She grew up in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, in a coal mining town. In 1950, she moved to New York, and in 1952, she married pianist Duke Jordan, who she later separated from. In 1963, she made her recording debut on a Blue Note record called Portrait of Sheila, an album that I believe is now out of print. New, more recent records are available, and they're called Sheila, a bass and voice duet on Steeplechase Records, Confirmation, a Japanese import, and the two records on ECM, the Sheila Jordan Steve Coon Band, an album called Playground, and an album of Robert Creeley poems set to music under Steve Swallow's name. The album is called Home. We'll be broadcasting a concert of hers on Sunday, April 26th at 10 o'clock as part of our Fat Tuesdays concert broadcast series. So that's April 26th at 10 o'clock. But if you'd like to see her in person, you'll have an opportunity to do that on May 2nd when she'll be in Philadelphia for a benefit concert for WXPN Radio. This will also be a bass and voice duet with bass player Harvey Schwartz. The concert is Saturday, May 2nd at 8 o'clock at the Houston Hall Auditorium, and that's on the Penn Campus. The address is 3417 Spruce Street, and it's at 8 o'clock, and I'd like to give you a number for more information if you'd like to call about it, and that's 387-5401. Again, that's 387-5401. Sheila, it's great to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you, Terry. I'm very happy to be here.
When did you first realize that you could sing? I mean, all kids sing, but only some kids really have a gift for singing, and you must have realized yours at some point.
I grew up in about 12 miles outside of Johnstown, near a coal mining town, and we used to have radio programs. We used to have, you'd enter these contests, and I always sang for school benefits with no music, naturally. You know, nobody was going to get up there and accompany you in those days. But I used to sing a lot. I think, too, where I come from, the need to sing was very prevalent among most of the miners. It was an outlet for the kind of pain and life that they lived and that we all lived. It was very rough growing up. I mean, none of us had any indoor plumbing, and heat was very scarce except from coal and wood when, you know, the pump was outside, the outhouse was outside. So you really, you know, music sort of saved us, I would say. So I think it was inborn, like it is in most of the people that have really struggled. I think it's God's way of letting us have an outlet so we don't kill ourselves and say, well, what's this all for, you know? I would say it's just an ingrown thing, and I did it from the need to preserve myself.
But the music you were probably hearing from the other people in the town you grew up with probably wasn't jazz. How did you get exposed to jazz?
I got exposed to jazz when I was about 12. My grandparents raised me in Pennsylvania, and my mother, I would visit her in the summer. The reason she didn't raise me, she was only 16 when she had me. So I would go and visit her in the summer, and there happened to be a guy a few years older than me that lived next door, and he had these jazz records. And he gave me one, in fact. I traded him some record that they had in my mother's house, her apartment, and he gave me, I think it was a Count Basie record, you know, 78, and I took it back home. Of course, we didn't have any electricity, so we had one of those roll-up Victrolas, and I got that thing working and played it. Because I remembered hearing it in his house in Detroit, and I was very, very turned on to it.
Were you able to figure out what was happening and to sing that way?
No, I think that with, no, I it's just that I knew it. It was just natural. I heard it, and it was natural, and I just felt very good about it. We, a lot of times I would visit a friend in town who had a radio in this little town I grew up in Pennsylvania, and they used to have hit parade and songs like that. So I was all, my ears were always open. Any house I went into that they might have a radio, I would hear like a lot of the music and remember it. And I think in those days, don't forget, a lot of these great old standards were being played. They were the hits at that time, so it was a natural thing for me to get into singing the current hits of the day, which are, hey, the tunes that are very, some of them are jazz classics now.
What does it mean to you to be a jazz singer? How do you describe what jazz singing is?
Jazz singing to me is putting into song the experiences of my life and the experiences that I've seen in other person's lives. It's just really a way of life for me. I can't imagine being without it. It's a necessity. It's like drinking or sleeping or eating. It's very part of my of what I am. And then there's also a spiritual thing that takes over, which I feel, I know this sounds very off the wall, but I've always felt I was given a gift, a very special gift, and that it was mine as long as I took care of it and gave it. So I feel it's something that I have to give to people, and I'm just overly grateful when they accept it, understand it, and get a feeling from it for what it is, and then give back in the way of thank you.
A lot of jazz singers got their start, and blues singers too, got their start in the black church. And being from, not being from the black tradition, and being from a coal mining town in Pennsylvania, do you feel like your approach to the jazz repertoire or to jazz singing is different?
No, because when I was a kid, I was basically raised a Catholic. My grandmother was a Catholic. My grandfather was an atheist because he's part American Indian. So she used to have to really sneak us out to church in the morning. I mean, he didn't get that upset about it, but he couldn't understand why we were going out to church every morning without eating breakfast, especially when we were having Holy Communion. He never understood that. But to make my point about singing in church, at that time, women or young girls were not allowed to sing in church. It was always an all-male choir. And I was very, very upset because one of the things I always envisioned was like really singing in church. I really wanted to do that because, again, I had this music that I wanted to sing. And it was, you know, even it was hard then to sing it. There was not always a place where you could sing except maybe the school socials. And so I was quite brought down when I was a kid not being able to sing in the church. It wasn't until years later in the 60s when there was no place out there for me to sing that I started doing jazz liturgies. So I reversed. I went from jazz singing into church singing, although it was jazz, but I sort of reversed it. Some, like a lot of black singers, start out in the church and end up into the jazz clubs or concerts. I started singing in clubs and a few concerts and the one album I did and went to the church when there was no place else to sing.
Pretty early on in your singing, I think you got turned on to Charlie Parker's music and got to meet him and sing with him too, I believe.
Yes, I did. I sat in a lot with Bird. I met Bird in Detroit when I was a teenager. I moved from Pennsylvania with my grandmother and went to live with my mother for the 3 years or 4 years of high school. It was time. At that time, I felt she was ready to sort of have me, and I had more of a chance to expand into schooling. There wasn't that much schooling back home. I'm the only one in my family that ever went through high school. Everybody else is sort of like sixth grade, fifth grade, you know, self-taught. So I went there to go to high school, and I went to Cass Tech High School and also took courses in commerce, which I eventually graduated from commerce because of the commercial studies that I took, typing, to enable me later on, as I do today, type. But at that time, they had a fantastic jukebox downstairs, and it had all of these great, great records, you know, Prez and... But Bird was the one that did it for me. I heard this thing. I said, oh, who is this man? What is this music? I mean, I really felt that it was just there for me. It was just planned that way, that I was going to hear this music, and I just got right into it. Well, of course, I couldn't move after that into anything else except jazz, even though I'd been singing, never gave up singing, and always had to sing. This was it for me. So after hearing these Bird records, and finding out where music like this was heard, I had to be there, even if it was a matter of life and death, which in Detroit at that time it was.
What do you mean?
Well, it was very prejudiced, and here I am, a young white girl, trying to get to this music. So in order to get to that music, it was in black neighborhoods, and the police were very rough. I mean, we had the race riots there, which didn't help matters. And so I was sort of torn between this terrible racial tension and wanting to be near these people who did this music and not even thinking in terms of black, white, purple, green. Hey, I just wanted to be where this music was. So I suffered a lot from constantly being taken down to police stations, quizzed about what I was doing with these black people, and of course that's not what they called them, and having to defend my relationship and my friendship with these wonderful people who taught me the art of jazz singing. I mean, they were my roots, all of these wonderful musicians and just people who were learning like myself, like Tommy Flanagan, Barry Harris, I mean, Kenny Burrell. We all grew up together. I mean, we were kids together. There wasn't anything strange going on, you know. We were learning.
As a white person, were you considered to be too outside the tradition, jazz tradition?
You mean in
white
circles?
You accepted within black circles?
Oh, absolutely. No problem at all. I mean, I was accepted with welcome arms. Like, they weren't black to me or any color. I mean, I wasn't white to them. We were kids, and we were growing up, and we were feeling, and you know, we would have died for one another.
What was your way of interpreting what Parker was doing with his horn into a vocal style?
Well, I started out singing with two young black guys who wrote a lot of words to Bird Heads, and I wanted to be part of their trio. I wanted to sing with them, and they accepted me, and we used to rehearse all the time, and that turned me on to more listening to what Bird was doing. But of course, I had done that before I met them. I don't know. I just, as I said, I felt very drawn to Bird's music, and I could hear it. I could hear, hey, that's Embraceable You, or that's I Got Rhythm, but what does he do with the bridge, or that's Honeysuckle Rose, but he plays another thing in the middle. I mean, I had very good ears, and I could hear all that. I didn't deliberately set out to learn Bird. I was drawn to it. I really felt that there was a stronger force than myself pushing me into this need to learn this man's music, to know all I could.
I know that you sang along with some of his records,
always,
with some of his solos.
Always.
Did you hear the chord changes as they were happening? Do you think in terms of chord changes when you're improvising?
Yes, I do. I hear the chord and then I improvise on the chord. Yes, I do. Especially if I'm doing improvised singing without words. I hate the word scat anymore. It's become so overused. And I think this kind of singing, this particular kind of creative singing, is an art in itself. I always listen for chord changes, whether it's with lyrics, actually, or just with sound. The chord changes are very important to me, especially if it's a structured song, you know, a 32-bar song. Yes, mm-hmm. Very much so.
You moved to New York in 1950. Did you know that that's where you had to be to do
Yes, I was
to
chasing the bird. I was chasing the bird, yeah. I had to go. I had to be near this music. I had to be near Bird.
Let's jump ahead, and then we'll get back
of
a little
course.
Bit to, like, 1963, when your Portrait of Sheila record was first released. Can you give us the story behind the release of this record, your first one?
I don't know if it was released in 63 or 62. Maybe it was 63. I guess it was. It was recorded in 62, because the first thing I really did was the You Are My Sunshine for the Coal Miners of Pennsylvania. And that came out I recorded that just a month before I did the Portrait album.
Well, this was it. This was your first album. What did you want it to say about you? It's your big chance to spread your music to people who've never heard it.
I guess I wasn't even thinking in terms of that. I think what I was thinking of is I go down to this club two nights a week in the village, and I sing my songs, and George Russell brought this man, brought a tape to this man at Blue Note, who was very interested in my sound and my feeling. And I just went into the studio never thinking, well, now I'm really going to be going into the jazz clubs. I mean, I was very content to sing in this club two nights a week. And I guess what it was a form of a legacy, something to leave, to say, I've been here and I've lived my life to my best, and I want to give you this. I want to leave you this because you were gracious enough to accept it. So I think it was more of that than thinking in terms of, well, now I'm going to work and now I'm going to become a star. I never really, and still don't, think in terms of star. If I did, I would want to be a singer with a trio, which is obviously what I don't want to be.
Okay, and we'll get to that a little bit later. But let's listen to one of Sheila Jordan's recordings, and this is from her first album, Portrait of Sheila. We're going to hear Falling in Love with Love, a Rodgers and Hart tune. And again, this is from her first album on Blue Note, Portrait of Sheila.
Falling in love with love is falling for make-believe. Falling in love with love is playing the fool. Caring too much is such a juvenile fancy. Learning to trust is just for children in school. I fell in love with love one night when the moon was high. I was unwise with eyes unable to see. I fell in love, with love everlasting. Then love fell out with me. Falling in love with love is falling for make-believe. Falling in love with love is playing the fool. Caring too much is such a juvenile fancy. Learning to trust is just for children in school. I fell in love with love one night when the moon was high. I was unwise with eyes unable to see. I fell in love with love, with love everlasting. Then love fell out. Love is falling for make-believe. Falling in love with love is playing the fool. Caring too much is such a juvenile fancy. Learning to trust is just for children in school. I fell in love with love one night when the moon was high. I wasn't wise with eyes unable to see. I fell in love, with love everlasting. Then love fell out with, love fell out with me.
Sheila Jordan from her first album, recorded in 1962. My guest is Sheila Jordan, and I'd like to remind you that she'll be doing a concert in Philadelphia on May 2nd. And this will be a benefit concert for WXPN Radio. And the concert will start at 8 on Saturday evening, May 2nd, at Euston Hall. And you can call 387-5401 for more information about the concert. So we left off at the point when you had recorded this record that mm-hmm. we just heard, and you mm-hmm. talked about how you'd meant it to be some kind of legacy or document. But what happened when the record came out? How was it received? Did it change your life in any way?
No, I still kept working in the club and my two nights, and I still kept my day job. And I think there was a slump in jazz in the 60s when this album came out. And at the time I recorded this album, I originally wanted it to be a bass and voice album, just Steve Swallow and myself. But they said, well, I don't know. You know, it's a great idea, but let's not try that right now. So it ended up being guitar, bass, and drums. But no, it didn't change too much. I think Blue Note did all they could. They were wonderful to record for, and it was a one-time shot with the possibility. I think I was the first singer. There might have been a blues singer that they recorded around the same time, but I would say that I was the first singer, or the second singer on their label. And I think they only recorded one other singer. This is the old now, when Al Lyons and Francis Wolfe had the label before they sold it. I didn't expect too much to happen from it, and I was just happy, as I said, to leave that.
Yeah. Let's go back to the 50s again, right after you moved to New York. You mm-hmm. married a pianist, Duke Jordan, who's
right.
still recording now. What was it like to be married to a jazz musician? Because you had been performing, your career hadn't exactly taken off yet then. It was before you had recorded or anything. But once you were married, were you still able to get out and perform the way you wanted to?
No, because shortly after that, about a year or so later, I would still sit in with Bird, you know, because Duke would be working with Bird. And Bird was wonderful to me, even as a kid. Anytime he'd come to town, a lot of people say, well, did he ever give you any encouragement or any inspiration? What's more encouraging than to have a great person like Charlie Parker up there on the stage playing away and inviting three young kids to get up and sing? If that's not encouragement, I don't know what is. But I would sit in with him at certain clubs. He would ask me to sing. And I guess, you know, it was... there was just not too... there was not too much happening in terms of where I was going or what I was going to do. Duke was sort of into his thing, and although there was one time Transition Records wanted to record an album of me and Duke together, and at that time I had a very, very bad throat the day he recorded, and my daughter was just a tiny little baby. She wasn't even like 3 months old, and I think what happened was I started saying, well, I need to take care of this little baby. And Duke wasn't ultra supportive in what I did, and that's not putting him down. He just seemed to be so busy struggling with his own music that to have me out there doing it too, it seemed it just didn't come easy. So I was very happy to take a back seat at that time. And at that time I started studying, before Duke and I got married, I started studying with Lenny. And he had sessions on Saturday night, so that was a chance for me to sing. See, my thing wasn't so much to go out there and make some money. It was just release all this music I had within me that I wanted to sing. So a little session here, a little sit-in there, and I used to have sessions in my loft, too, at that time, which Duke and I had. I had found this loft before we were married, and I used to always have sessions there. Everybody sat in there. Bird, Sonny Rollins, Monk, everybody came up to the loft and played. It was before it was popular to have loft jazz, and I didn't charge.
How are you treated as a woman in jazz during that period? Is there a different way that male musicians are treating women now than, say, in the 50s?
Working with Steve Kuhn's quartet, I feel really on an equal basis. I would think that I remember now, not so much from a woman, but that could have had something to do. There was always a prejudice against singers.
Oh, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. So I would say that more than a woman, but just as a singer, and believe me, a lot of the musicians had every right to feel that way, because a lot of singers get up there, they don't know what they're doing, or even if they don't know what they're doing, if something goes wrong, they give the musicians a dirty look and badmouth them, and it's kind of hard to take from a musician standpoint. So I think there was a lot of prejudice toward singers, say, especially women, you know, women singers.
Well, part of what a singer is supposed to do is to be in front of a band being very glamorous, like wearing a gorgeous glittery gown, or at least that's what it used to be, and then to have album jackets with, you know, a lot
very
of cleavage
sexy,
showing.
Tiny, yeah.
Yeah, real coy, tigerish.
Yeah, well, that's not me. I mean, I knew that a long time ago. I didn't have the body to go along with that stuff, and even if I did, you know, I wasn't out there, and I don't knock that. I mean, I don't knock anything that anybody does in order to get across what they have to do. But as I said before, it's that same thing again. This is something that I had to do, whether I was a star at doing it or whatever. It's just a place to do it, and so any chance I got, I would sing, you know. I think with Duke, after my daughter was born, it was just too much. For him to handle, and of course we separated it after she was about a year old, and it was after that, actually, when my daughter was about 2 or 3 years old, I started singing again. I got a job in the village, and I worked in this club 5 nights, and then I couldn't make it working days and nights and taking care of her. So it went to 4 to 3 to 2. I ended up doing 2 nights until finally the club closed in the early 60s.
It must have been hard being a single mother and having a day job and singing
in
the club.
Yeah, it was, because I'd get home at 4, and then I'd get up and take her to nursery school, and then I'd go on type until about 1, and then I'd pick her up. So it was kind of, it was difficult, but I managed, and I'm not sorry for it. It made me strong.
Did you ever want to sell out? Did you ever want to find a fancy supper club where you'd maybe be singing material you weren't crazy about, but you'd make a good living and you wouldn't have to have that day job?
No, because I really don't have the, that's where I don't have the strength or pizzazz or whatever you want to call it. It's not born in me to be able to get a feeling out of doing something that is not mine, or I don't feel strong enough about. So when I sing songs, they really have to have something in them that I can identify with. And I've never been out there to try to impress anyone with what I do. So a supper club scene just never occurred. I just didn't, unless I could do it my way. I feel this way. I don't mind working in an office and typing and doing my little menial office job, because I know when somebody calls me up to sing at a club or at a concert or whatever, it's because they know what I sing like, and it's strictly for that sound or that feeling that I have that is mine, that they want. So I feel, this way it's going to be true to what I do.
Some people who have day jobs and then are like an actress or a singer or dancer at night feel like really schizophrenic, because in some jobs you have to become somebody else in order to be acceptable in the place that you work. You have to sometimes dress differently and take on a different personality. And can you be yourself where you're working? And do people know about your
records?
Yes,
they do. They don't. They know that. A lot of them say, what are you doing here? Do you know, like, if you just sang straight, you could be out there? I said, what is singing straight? Tell me what singing straight is. Listen, please, I don't want to hear about it. And, really, let's not get into that, because you're getting into a part of me that you know nothing about. And I don't get into your thing. I mean, what are you doing here? Maybe you do something else you'd rather do. I said, don't make me feel sorry for myself. Don't make me think things that I don't want to think. I just am not interested in discussing the kind of music I do. It's a love, and it's like throwing over a lover or a child. I mean, this is part of me. I feel this is like my right or my left arm or any part of my body. That's how important the music that I sing is to me. So I don't want to hear about what is money. I mean, the gratification I get from singing is so superior of a feeling and rising to a plateau that money could never buy. There's no way in the world I could buy the feeling that I get from expressing what I feel to a group of wonderful people who are listening. There's nothing like it, and you can't buy that with money.
I don't doubt that. Let's listen to another one of your records. This is, again, from an album called Sheila, and this is the Steeplechase album, and it's duets with Sheila Jordan and bass player Harold Anderson. And this is an old standard called Please Don't Talk About Me When I'm Gone. Do you want to say anything about this before we hear it?
It's a great standard tune. That's it's a good vehicle to sort of, the feelings are good. I like the words. I like the words since Billy sang it, and it's just one of those good standard tunes that you can just sort of stretch out with your feeling and your emotion and your creativity. I like these kind of standards to do, because they never come out the same way twice. I love this is, again, listening to changes. And in this particular instance, I basically improvise on the words, because I don't do any creative sound things on this. But the words are, every time I sing them, like, I really mean these words, but I say them differently each time, because it's a different feeling every time I say, please don't talk about me, or I should say, sing about it.
Okay, well, let's hear it.
Okay.
Please don't talk about me when I'm gone. Oh, honey, though our friendship ceases from now on, you can't say anything real nice, it's better not to say a word, that's my advice. Where about you go, yeah, well, go on, best I would do. Here's a kiss, I hope that it brings lots of luck to you. Makes no difference how I carry on. Please don't talk about me when I'm gone. Please don't talk about me when I'm gone. Our friendship ceases from now on. And listen if you can't say anything real nice, it's better not to say a word, that's my advice. We're burning. No difference how I carry on. Please don't talk about me when I'm
Sheila Jordan with Harold Anderson from a bass and duet record that was Please Don't Talk About Me When I'm Gone, and the album is on Steeplechase Records. Sheila Jordan is with me in the studio visiting us from New York today, and I want to remind you that she'll be paying another visit to Philadelphia on Saturday, May 2nd for a concert at 8 o'clock at Euston Hall and 3417 Spruce Street. And again, for more information, you can call 387-5401. You do an interesting mix of standards, like pre-bop standards, bop standards, and mm-hmm. of much more free kind mm-hmm. of stuff, modern stuff. How do you choose a tune? What do you look for in it?
The first thing I look for is the music. I mean, if it's constructed so that it's really a good melody and it really has the depth that I like to hear in music that's good for me, as a vehicle for me, that's what I look for first, which doesn't mean that I don't have any regard for lyrics. I have all regard for lyrics, but I feel it's much easier to fit a bad lyric and change it than, say, it is to change the music. So you can have, like, a great melody with rotten lyrics, with, you know, really lyrics that, I shouldn't say rotten, but lyrics that don't mean anything to me. I can always change the lyrics around.
What's an example of a song that you do where the lyrics don't mean much to you?
I don't have any. A word here or there, I'm trying to think. I do this, I see your face before me, and there's a lyric in there that says, it doesn't matter where you are, I can see how fair you are. That throws me a curve. I don't like that word fair. Fair skin. What does that mean? You know, that to me is, I know, like, my daughter's not fair skin, so I just don't like that word. So I can change that by saying, I can feel how near you are, to how fair you are. instances like that. Not that I say that's a bad lyric, but to me, it doesn't go with how I feel. And just little cases like that, I might change it around because it has more significance to me than what's already there.
What do you look for in a melody? Can you describe that?
I like something that has a thrilling kind of... this is very hard to describe, but sometimes changes on immediately as you hear them. You know, oh, that song is so beautiful. I just love the way it flows along, and it's got this really beautiful melody line, and, oh, I can hear all of these different approaches to singing it, to my feeling into it. You can hear where you can go above it harmonically or go below it or slide in between it, which I do a lot of, not by force, but from natural. I hear, a lot of times I hear in quarter tones, and people take that as singing flat. But it's not. I'm a quarter tone singer from the mountains. Because the mountains, I was raised in nature, and I always sang as a kid, alone, walking down the mountains. And I used to love to hear the sound of the wind and the trees as against the human voice, any voice.
Or against the piano, I guess.
Yeah, so I hear that.
Those are sounds that don't exist on the piano.
Well, except with Kuhn. He's one of the very few pianists that I can really hear some marvelous changes in some of the things he does and keeps doing and keeps improvising on have become really kind of frightening. I used to think my favorite instrument was bass and voice, which it still is. You know, this concert that we're doing will be me and Harvey Swartz. So that's a bass and voice, and that was a hard decision in some ways to decide whether to do it with bass or piano, only because I've gotten a thing going with Kuhn duet that I've never had with another piano player. I've never felt the need for anything else with Kuhn.
When you're improvising, what are you thinking about?
It's not thinking. It's a feeling. It's not thinking at all. It's the feeling that comes into me where it's almost sometimes, if it's really off and it's really happening, I really am not in my body. I'm not there. It's not, I don't know. I'm there, but I'm not. It's almost like I totally remove myself. It's like a spiritual thing that overtakes me. And it pushes me, and it just sort of guides me, it leads me along, and the sounds are there, and I hear them before I actually sing them, and it's like a very spiritual happening. The sound happens, and then it comes out of my mouth, and a lot of times I think, oh my God, where did that come from? But I knew it was there, and I knew it was going to happen. It's a strange feeling. Times, and of course you don't always have this feeling. There are times when you're more, when it's not happening, when it's new material that you're working on. You really try to get involved with your particular feeling for this song. And you're hearing, and you hear the song, you know what the original melody is. And you hear the chord change, and you can do one of two things. You can stay where it's written, or you can go somewhere else that you feel is stronger. I never push improvisation. I don't believe in it. I believe that you, and this goes for a lot of young singers too. A lot of times they like to go completely from the melody. Well, hell, a lot of times the melody is much prettier than the change that they might decide to use. I mean, you really have to be very careful and select, and I think a lot of that comes from experience, from hearing, and being true to yourself, and not trying to show how hip you are, you know. And that's the same with scat singing. I think a lot of singers make a bad choice of syllables when they scat sing, just to prove how hip they are. And there are a lot of shooby doobies and doo-wah things happening. And I think until you really have your own true feeling within your sound, you should really take it easy on what you scat on and take it slow.
How has your singing been changed by your experiences?
Oh, that's what my singing is. Everything I do is from my own life's experience or other people that I've been involved with or have known or am friends with. I sing about life. I sing about what I see, what I feel every day. My morning begins with a song. My life is song. I really believe that. And it's a sad song or it's a happy song or it's just what's happening around me. I'm very tuned into people. I'm very perceptive to their feelings, and I'm very careful because I don't like to hurt feelings, even though sometimes people deserve to be told, you know, you really are a drag sometimes. I'm very even careful about that because I want people to tell me if I'm a drag, you know, and let me know that I'm doing something that is hurting them or they don't like. But I've always been tuned into people, and I believe in mankind, and I think the reason I feel this way is because of the music that's just born in me to do, and it has to do with living and life.
You grew up hearing a lot of singers. Was it ever a temptation to, not even a temptation, but sometimes you can't help imitating someone. What you like sometimes, what you've heard becomes so much a part of you that you open your mouth and suddenly you're talking that way or singing that way. Did that ever happen to you?
No, because I was fortunate because of Bird. I mean, I listened to Bird. I got turned on to Bird totally before any singer. And so the fact that I sang as a little kid, I've been singing since I was 3. So I've always sung, you know, on little radio programs, school programs. I would feel like a thief. It's like I have a bootleg album out that somebody put out on me. There's a singer on one side that isn't even me singing. The bad part of it is it was also called Sheila. It's on Grapevine Discovery, and it came out at the same time my Bass and Voice album came out with the same title, Sheila. I feel that was musical rape, you know, and the woman who's singing on there, who I don't know it is, she sings one track. I mean, she must feel terrible if she knows it's out there. I feel terrible that she's on there and that she's not getting the credit. But to sing somebody else's thing when I know it isn't mine, just in general speaking, I mean in general singing or speaking, if you, like, sometimes they get to the point where they start talking like the artist. I mean, not only do they sing like them or play like them, they talk like them, they have their mannerisms. I think that's robbery. I think that's human robbery. Yeah, that's stealing, and I don't go for that.
Are you insulted or flattered when a young singer has obviously listened to you a lot and is using some of your phrasing?
If they give credit. But most of them don't give credit. Have you ever heard of Betty Carter? Oh, no, you know, like they'll immediately say, oh, no, who is she? Have you ever heard of Sheila Jordan? No, I've never heard of her. And, you know, like especially what I really hate most is when they take something and they take it exactly off the record and then they don't say, they pretend they never heard of you. That, I think, bothers me. If they call me up and say, you know, I love you and I'm really very influenced by you, you know, I try to say, well, I'm very flattered, but please, you know, you must also work on your own sound because look at where, you know, are you trying to make it? And money-wise and star-wise, if you are, you better copy somebody that's out there making some money because you're on the wrong singer, you know. But if you're just really dedicated, then you should really get your own sound eventually. I'm flattered, but only up to a point. If they keep it happening and they don't really look for their own true sound, then I really feel they're not doing themselves justice.
I know you're very sensitive about not wanting to be categorized as the singer playing with the trio and that you see the groups you work with as a working band and you're all equal parts within this working band. Why is that such an issue with you?
I don't mind, you know, to sing is to sing. I have preferences. I like to be part of the Steve Kuhn Quartet. It's one of the best situations I've been into vocally. Now, a lot of people that just want to hear me sing will not find that so appetizing if they just want to hear me sing. But I have a chance to create more, to be freer, to have the pressure taken off of me as the singer, how long the set's going to last, and actually to be more, to get more creative ideas because I am really fitting in to what this quartet is doing. I'm just not standing aside at the end of what I've sung and hearing a piano player take a half a chorus and then jumping right back in again, or taking a chorus, because everybody that's playing in the Steve Kuhn Quartet is very special, and they're all extremely creative, and I might hear something from them, which lately I've gotten into doing, and singing underneath it. You know, lately I sometimes accompany Harvey on bass, you know, like I'll get a thing going and I'll be singing a line underneath him. It's so exciting, and it gives me a chance to even achieve more, because I don't feel, if you're really creative, you ever find your goal. I mean, I learn something new every time I open my mouth, and I hope I'll always do that.
You came to New York 31 years ago, about 30, 31 years ago.
In 1952.
52.
Uh-huh.
About 30 years ago. What are some of the differences in the jazz scene in New York when you came and now?
Well, when I first came here, naturally, Bird was on the scene, and Monk, and Bud Powell, and Miles, and Sonny was just coming up, and Jackie McLean, and I sort of hung out with them. It was exciting to go into these clubs, these 52nd Street clubs, and hang out there and hear this, you know, you could go across the street and hear Bud, you could go across the street and hear Bird, I mean, Max, they were all on the scene. Oh, it was thrilling, and of course for a kid, you know, at that time, especially if you were into jazz, like I, totally into jazz and dedicated to it, it was very exciting. Plus, you know, into the 50s, there were sessions, that they don't have sessions anymore. And that's one thing that I'm unhappy about with some of the young singers coming up and the young players. Nobody gets together anymore to exchange feelings and ideas. So therefore, I think a lot of singers tend to maybe copy a little bit more, because they don't really have a chance to go out there and just take a song and fit it into their thing and session on it and work with it and, you know, get it off the ground. So they're more apt to listen to records. I miss that, you know. The loft scenes today are you pay to get in, a show is set. When I had my loft, people just sessioned. We were exchanging ideas. The same way in Detroit. Detroit was the only place I know that had a club called the Club Sudan that had kids that could come in under 21, and there was no liquor sold. So there were always sessions happening, and in New York, always sessions, but that doesn't happen anymore.
You right now are recording, you have a few new albums that have been released in the past couple of years. You've been doing a lot of concerts in the States as well as some tours through Europe. But you're also still working this day job where you're typing in an advertising agency. Mm-hmm. If you could like chart out your ideal situation as a singer, what would it be?
Oh, Terry, you know, I'm going to just pretend that that some genie came on the scene, okay? You're the genie. And what is my wish? Say I have a wish. I would love to be able to devote the 8 hours a day that I type into just music, to learning more about music, to maybe try at composing some music myself, and to just spend that 8 hours a day and not get paid any more than what it costs me to live, rent-wise. No big cars, no fancy clothes, no diamond rings. Just to be able to live, that somebody would say, here, Sheila, I'm going to give you $12,000 a year. And you live on that. And whatever you make in gigs, you can pay back off that $12,000. That would be the, I say $12,000 now because that's approximately what it would cost me to live. Of course, every year it gets a little higher. That would be my ideal situation. No, just the way I'm living now, but to be able to, the 8 hours I spend, do nothing but live and breathe music. That would be ideal for me. I would love that. If that ever happens, I doubt it. I don't think there's any genies out there going to come to my door and say, well, we heard you on Terry Gross's. She's a wonderful interviewer, and here you are, you know?
It seems to me, though, that you're getting a lot closer to that, you know, that with your new records and mm-hmm. with the attention that the jazz press and the popular press has been paying to you, that your audience is expanding and that things may start to change as far as being able to truly support yourself from your music.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. But I have one outlet in 9 years. I'll be 62. So hopefully if Social Security is still around, I'll be able to retire and still, you know, have a little bit of income and have the time for the music. And I think that I'm only going to probably become, you know, like, better at what I'm trying to do, because, you know, I haven't even touched on what I want to sing yet. So I think even if I have to wait till I'm 62 to do it, I, you know, that's all right. I hope to be around then and enjoy some of that. And I want to just tell you something, if I might say it on the radio. I think you're a wonderful interviewer.
Oh, thanks, Sheila.
I really am relaxed, and you really have touched on certain things that I don't get asked very often. So I want to really thank you.
Oh, thank you, Sheila. Our time is up. I want to thank you so much for coming down
pleasure.
And talking with us. And I'm going to let you go because I know you have a train to catch.
Yeah.
So we'll spend the rest of the hour playing some of your records. And before we do that, I want to ask you if you have any favorites or if you, you know, don't discriminate between your work.
No, I don't. I really don't have any favorites. I like, I always liked Baltimore Oriole because of the, of this, a different kind of a thing with birds, you know. I thought that. I would also like to say one other thing about the grants. The grants helped me out a lot. I got a couple of grants in the last, I let 2 years go by and then I apply for one. But this has helped me. This has enabled me to leave my job when I have to take a leave of absence. So I must say, even if I don't have a genie coming to my door, I mean, the grants helped me a lot, you know, when to cover. It wasn't much, but it was enough for me.
Well, I wish you the best, and I'm
you.
Looking forward to hearing you in May. And that concert again is on May 2nd. And if you'd like to hear Sheila Jordan, it's May 2nd at Euston Hall, 3417 Spruce Street. That's a Saturday night. And you can call WXPN at the benefit concert for them for more information at 387-5401. Thanks again, Sheila Jordan. It's been wonderful to talk to you.
Well, I hope I'll see you again real soon.
Likewise.
Bye-bye.
Let's listen to another of Sheila's records, and this is from the Japanese import Confirmation. Then we'll get to one of her recordings with the Sheila Jordan Steve Kuhn Band afterwards. This is from the album Confirmation, and we'll hear singing God Bless the Child.
That God shall get, them that's not shall lose. So the good book says, and it still is news, Mama. Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Mom.
We've been listening to Sheila Jordan from her album Confirmation, which is a Japanese import. And in a moment, we'll be hearing her with the Steve Kuhn Band. And she was talking about how much she enjoys playing with this group, which includes Steve Kuhn piano, Harvey Swartz bass, and Bob Moses drums. But first, Sheila Jordan and Harvey Swartz will be playing a duet concert on Saturday, May 2nd in Philadelphia. This is a benefit concert for WXPN. And it will be at the Houston Hall Auditorium, 3417 Spruce Streets. And if you'd like any more information, you can call 387-5401. Well, before we close out the show with another one of the Sheila Jordan records, and we'll be hearing Deep Tango, I'd like to tell you what's coming up Monday afternoon on Fresh Air. At 2 o'clock, we'll be joined by Maria Thaddeus, who is a storyteller, and her stories come from her own life. We'll be hearing a story that she tells about her experiences during World War II. At 3:30, Judy Steinfresher's arts critic will be with us with a review of museum and gallery shows around town. Then at 4 o'clock, we begin the rebroadcast of the series Alec Wilder and the American Popular Songs. I hope you can join us then. Contributing to this afternoon's Fresh Air was Bill Van Wert, and the technical director was Jay Goldman. The production assistant for Fresh Air is Maeve McGoran. The associate producer of the show is Danny Miller. My name's Terry Gross. I wish you a very good evening. Have a good weekend, and thanks for listening.
Remember. the tango. Tango. Friends are not forever and a day. Stop on a dime, this time as the music seems a light year away.
This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. This is Noah Adams.
And I'm Sanford Unger, with All Things Considered.
Carnegie and the United States are absolutely synonymous. When they say, I'm going to the United States, that means they're going to play at Carnegie Hall. Or they say, I'm playing Carnegie Hall, or I'm playing in Carnegie Hall, yeah?
It was going to be called Music Hall. New York City needed a concert auditorium, but the European musicians thought Music Hall sounded too much like a vaudeville place, so Andrew Carnegie's name went along with his money. Tonight on All Things Considered, the echoes of 90 years of music with Isaac Stern.
We also have these stories tonight. The Polish government recognizes a farmers' union, and that may calm the crisis there for a while.
The Boston schools may be closed for the rest of the year, unless emergency funds are found soon.
A push to revive the anti-ballistic missile system, ABM.
The fighting continues over auto imports.
Also a fight over a nominee to the Department of Health and Human Services.
A new business stirs controversy, surrogate motherhood.
Also a camel trip across the Australian desert.
Talking elevators and other disembodied voices.
And a special report on gay religion.
That and more tonight on All Things Considered. First, Richard Harris has this news.
The Reagan administration says it will not ask the Japanese to limit car exports to this country by any specific amount. Instead, Commerce Secretary Malcolm Baldrige says the U.S. will continue talks with Japan about voluntary restraints.
We will not be discussing any numbers with them. This is, if it occurred, would be a voluntary action on their part. The position of the administration is that we do not feel there should be legislated quotas in this case, and any action should be voluntary.
Baldrige says the Japanese have indicated a desire to take some voluntary action. If they don't, he couldn't predict whether Congress...